36 through 43. And we'll get there. And as you're turning, I want to say something. I want to say something actually to Kevin and Karen. Thank you, first of all, for sharing that testimony earlier in the service. When you describe having a spiritual encounter, a deep sacred experience, I think a lot of us resonate with that. That there are times when we have these encounters in which God is just clearly, so clearly drawing us to Him. But it reminds me real quick of this story in Exodus where Moses, he's up on a mountain and he's face to face with God. He's in the presence of God. And then it's time for him to leave the mountain. And Moses tells God, Lord, if you don't come with us where we are traveling to, then I'm not going to leave this mountain. I am not going to leave unless you're going to be coming with us. And what I love about that story is God's response to that is, yes, okay, I will go with you. And so we have these like sacred experiences in a 1,000-year-old church in Poland or wherever it is. And then we kind of go back into the regular rhythms of our lives. And God is faithful and He is faithfully with us. Christ, as He's leaving, He tells His disciples, I will be with you always. And there are times when we feel that. I mean, just really feel it in our bodies, in our souls. And there are times when we're sitting at the computer trying to schedule our work day and Christ is with us, but it's hard to just experience that. But God always says yes, that He goes with us, even when we're not having an experience that feels altogether sacred. So thank you for sharing that. Last week, I encouraged all of you to spend some time this week, 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, where you take some time to just be in the presence of God. And when I make that recommendation, it's not because, when we like sit and meditate and pray that God shows up. No, God is already there. This is our way of showing up for Him and being present. Now, quick accountability question. How many of you guys did your homework? We have got, first of all, some A students right here. So excellent. Good job. Hey, this sermon is going to end with some homework. Just, go ahead and get your calendar and write it down. Acts chapter 9, verse 36. In Joppa, there was a disciple named Tabitha. In Greek, her name is Dorcas. I heard earlier that the younger kids studied this story, so they're prepped for it. In Joppa, there was a disciple named Tabitha. In Greek, her name is Dorcas, and she was always doing good and helping the poor. About that time, she became sick and died. And her body was washed and placed in an upstairs room. Lydda was near Joppa, so when the disciples heard that Peter was in Lydda, they sent two men to him and urged him, please come at once. Peter went with them, and when he arrived, he was taken upstairs to the room. All the widows stood around him crying and showing him the robes and other clothing that Dorcas had made while she was still with them. Peter sent them all out of the room, and then he got down on his knees and prayed. Turning toward the dead woman, he said, Tabitha, get up. She opened her eyes, and seeing Peter, she sat up. He took her by the hand and helped her to her feet. And then he called for the believers, especially the widows, and presented her to them alive. This became known all over Joppa, and many people believed in the Lord. Peter stayed in Joppa for some time with a tanner named Simon. Okay. So I love a good funeral. Now, let me be clear. I love a good funeral. There are bad funerals. Okay, there are funerals in which we gather not to celebrate a life, but to cry out against the injustice of a person taken too soon. Those are bad funerals, and that is not what I love. But there are good funerals. And when I say that there are good funerals, I don't mean that they're easy funerals or painless, but something happens when a person passes, and their passing, though it's painful, it kind of follows the expectations of life's rhythms, okay? There are no surprises in this. And so we gather to remember such a person, to honor them, and to show love and respect to their families. And as we do that, we begin to tell stories of that person, memories. And let's be honest, the memories and the stories that we're telling during a funeral, during the meal after, maybe a few hours later, maybe the next few days, these stories are a little bit selective, aren't they? We allow grace to kind of wash away some of the dirt that maybe we remember. We're not going to talk about that. Instead, we're going to remember the things about that person that have been a blessing. By the way, John, so last week I told you that I was going to talk about you in the sermon today. And not this isn't the part where I'm going to be talking about you, okay? That's going to be later, not the funeral part. I was worried that you were going to be nervous hearing this. Okay, so sometimes we meet people at their own funeral. Do you know what I mean by that? Like, you go to a funeral, you don't actually know the person, but it's not until you're attending their memorial service that people are sharing stories and you get a sense of who this person was. About a year and a half ago, Becky Colson called me and she asked if I could help out with a funeral of somebody she knew. Becky, some of her work as an attorney includes taking care of the financial and legal affairs of people who, because of illness, because of age, can't do it by themselves. She helps out. And so one of her clients passed away. She gave me a call, said, hey, can you come and, you know, do the talkie and the praying part and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I love funerals, so I said, yeah. And I spent a couple of hours on the phone speaking to this woman's oldest daughter. And she's describing her life and telling stories. And as she's doing that, I'm listening for the kinds of things we might want to remember during the service. So what kind of mother was she? How much she loved her grandkids? The highlights of her career. She's a very successful woman. But the one thing that really stood out was how this woman had dedicated a lot of her life to serving and advocating for the deaf community in Houston. She herself was not deaf, but that became a real mission in her life. So I knew nothing about her. And to tell you the truth, I still don't really know much about her, but what I do know is the service that she performed and the good work that she did. A good funeral reveals the enduring power and influence of a person's good works and service. Sometimes we do not even know the enduring power of the good works and service that we do. Now, we have Tabitha's funeral here. And Tabitha's funeral was not a good funeral. It was one of the bad ones. It was one of those events when death has come and just taken her away, and it is a tragedy. Luke doesn't tell us a whole lot about her, but he does describe her in this way. She was a disciple who was always doing good and helping the poor. Now, I got to tell you something, like, if at the end of my life, if the only thing anybody knows about me, if the only memory anybody has of me is he was a disciple of Jesus and he was always doing good and helping the poor, that would be an amazing memory, wouldn't it? That'd just be a fantastic thing for people to remember you by. Tabitha is this. And she gets sick and she dies. And her family brings her body into the room above the house. There's an upper room there in order to prepare her for burial. And they're going to want to prepare her body quickly. In that culture, to leave the body unburied for, you know, overnight even, is that's a sign of dishonor. So they don't want to do that. They want to take care of things quickly. And as they take her body up there, two things begin to happen. First, a crowd begins to form around the house. Now, these are not just people gathering together to politely comfort the family. Okay, these are people who are wailing and crying. This is a loud crowd. Middle Eastern Jewish women do not mourn quietly to themselves. They wail in sorrow and they rage against the injustice of death. The second thing that begins to happen is two men get up out of that crowd, out of the house, and they leave. They go to get Peter. Tabitha's in the village of Joppa. They've heard that Peter the apostle is in Lydda. It's a town not very far away, maybe 5 or 6 hours. If you're walking, maybe they were running, maybe they can do that. They get to him, they want to bring him back because they have heard the news that Peter has miraculously healed a man named Aeneas in the city of Lydda. And so if Peter is nearby and if he's healing people, let's get him over here. So Peter arrives and he shows up, and when he shows up, he's in the middle of a wake. He is in the middle of the visitation as people are gathering to mourn. And they take Peter, they lead him through the crowd, through the house, past her family, past the people of her church. She's probably still connected to the synagogue, so lots of synagogue people there too. And he goes upstairs, and when he's upstairs, he meets a different crowd. It's a very particular group of women. Now, I don't imagine that Peter really knows who Tabitha is. In fact, I kind of wonder if Peter's a little bit confused as to just why it's so important that God has brought him to Joppa to heal her. If he doesn't know, there's a group of women up here who is about to explain it to him. They're about to explain to Peter why it is that she is so important. And these women are all widows. And we have a little bit of a stereotype, I hear it sometimes, where we think, okay, widows in the ancient world, if a woman's husband dies and she doesn't have a close male relative to sort of adopt her back into the household, then she's immediately going to be like destitute, cast out on the street. That's not really true. In the ancient world, women did have lots of property rights, and women, there were widows who owned their own property. And even so, usually there's a family around to take care of her. But there were also poor widows. There were also people who were vulnerable. And if they didn't have family, and especially if these widows were young, and if you can imagine this, they've gone through the trauma of losing their husbands, and maybe they don't have sons or children who are old enough to take care of them, they can be easily put in a place of real vulnerability, real economic instability. And it's a good possibility that that's the kind of people these women were. And so they gather around Peter, and they're trying to impress upon him just exactly how important Tabitha was to them. They're showing him the clothing that she made for them. The clothing, look, it's possible Tabitha was a businesswoman. Maybe she made clothes. Maybe she sold them in the market. So maybe she had some stuff lying around. She saw these women that they needed them, and she gave them to them as gifts. But people of low economic status often just made their clothes at home. And so if these women didn't have good clothing themselves, it's probably because they didn't have the resources to make their own clothes. They didn't have just the very basic things to look to wear durable clothing. And so she has stepped in to support them. So, when Luke describes Tabitha as a disciple who is always doing good and helping the poor, that's what this looks like. There's something tangible here that's evidence of that. It's widows who have good clothing because she's provided it for them. So, Tabitha's funeral is not a good one. She was not an older lady. The text says that she got sick, And that emphasizes that this is a sudden thing. The crowd in her house, this isn't just community coming to pay respects. These are her friends and the people who counted on her who are now weeping. Kevin, you described the Kadesh that you witnessed in Poland. You can imagine those same kinds of prayers being prayed here. Prayers of sorrow, of maybe even anger, like we read in the Psalms, but always entrusting God. But there is an impression that we get in all of this. It leaves a mark on Peter in his memory. And it's Peter who describes this to Luke, and Luke who describes it to us. And the impression is that Tabitha has done good work in love and service to her church. I mean, just think about this. Peter shows up to a funeral. He gets an impression of a person. The impression is something he gives to Luke. Luke writes it down, and 2,000 years later, we remember this woman's cloth. We remember the clothes that she made for her friends. Small stuff, right? I mean, little things, but have endured and have made a difference. And so, I say that because you don't know. You can never know just how our good deeds, and you're choosing to serve somebody, what difference that might make and how that might endure. So, the widows are crying. They're heartbroken. And they tell Peter their stories. They show him the clothes that she made. It's not the clothes that are important to them necessarily, but the clothes are the tangible physical evidence that Tabitha loved them, was concerned for them, and strove to help them. And so Peter does what Peter was brought here to do. He enters the room where her body lay. He shoos everybody else out, and when it's just the two of them, he gets on his knees and he prays. Jesus, when he healed people, when he raised them from the dead, he just did it. You know, Lazarus, get up and walk. He heals Jairus' daughter that way. Peter doesn't have that power. This is not coming from Peter. This is God. And so he kneels and he prays. And then having prayed, he tells Tabitha, get up. And she does, and he pulls her up out of the bed. And then it says that Peter calls out to the people who are outside the room, who are waiting, but especially the widows, Luke says. Because Luke knows that it's the widows who need to see Tabitha. And so he presents Tabitha to her. That language actually evokes the way you might present somebody to their family, because that's who these people are. They are family. She has adopted them. We've been examining, and we're kind of in the middle of a series that's examining what it means to be church together. We're trying to recover a little bit the biblical view of church as an expression of God's family. So church isn't just this, you know, big building that we have here. It's not just the 1 hour, maybe hour and a half if Roy's preaching, that we gather together in a hot room. You know, this isn't the totality of church. This is a gathering. This is worship. It's a rhythm that binds us together and that brings us into the experience of worshiping God. But that's not all that we are. Church is the community. It's created not by our deciding to be each other's community, but created by God's adoption of us. It's the expression of Jesus' work in this world, that as he breaks down the barriers between us and God, he's also breaking down the barriers between us and each other. And so when we are a community together, when we're church, we're expressing that. God's put us in relationship. And because he's put us in relationship, we have a responsibility to each other's well-being. We have a responsibility to serve each other. And that is what Tabitha exemplifies. Like all disciples, Tabitha understands that God's mission in the world was, that Jesus' mission in the world, as he put it, was not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. In our baptism, we are given this servant identity of Jesus. Jesus taught his disciples, saying that whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Now, Jesus isn't telling us this because he wants us to think poorly of ourselves. No, he wants us to have this servant identity, just as Jesus led a servant life that was the model for us. Paul, when Jesus washes his disciples' feet, that is his example, not just for us to remember, but for us to emulate. Thank you for bringing that up earlier. So, we take responsibility. We choose to take responsibility for the well-being of our brothers and sisters. To take responsibility, what does that mean? Okay, well, responsibility is the combination of two words, response and ability. If you see something and it needs a response and you have the ability to respond to it, you have responsibility. My football coach told me that like 10 years, 50, I don't know how old I am. I think a motivational speaker wrote that like 50 years ago, and since then preachers and teachers and coaches and Mary Kay consultants, they've been stealing this. So, but I do like it. Because that's what Tabitha does. She sees something in her church family that needs a response. She sees widows. And she sees women who have been through something terrible, and so she has an ability, and she is going to use that to bless them. I want to be clear about something, because it's something that gets thrown around when we talk about service. Tabitha's service is not random acts of kindness. That's not what we're seeing here. Instead, what we're seeing is her intention, her taking responsibility. She's not just walking around, keeping her eyes open, hoping for some opportunity to serve somebody. She's creating opportunity here. Tabitha employs a strategic service. First, she assesses the needs of her community. She looks around. What is going on here? What's needed? What's missing? And as she does, she identifies a particular need. There's some widows here. Now, there's probably other needs in that community. And in fact, Tabitha may, you know, she may do some things else that are for other people. But she does identify that there's a particular need and that maybe she can be particularly equipped to help. So she's assessing, she's looking around, she identifies a need. She adopts them, takes responsibility for them, and forms a relationship with them. How is it that Tabitha knows these women need clothing? She's probably not just taking a guess. Sometimes we just try to guess at what people need. But she has a relationship with these women. She knows them. They are her friends. And when you know somebody, when they're your friends, you tend to know the kinds of things that would make their lives better. She also knows herself. She understands her own skills and the resources that she comes equipped with. She can make clothes. She knows she can do that. And so that's what she does. Tabitha chooses to take responsibility for the people in her church, in her community. And she models some thoughtful, strategic, an effective service. Service that has lasted so long, we're still talking about it. So all this week, as I've been thinking about this sermon, I've been thinking actually a whole lot about some of you folks. In fact, many of you folks. Last Sunday was May 12th. May 12th is the fourth anniversary of Tiffany and I pulling up our U-Haul to our house. This is like the first day of being here in Houston and being a part of your family. So 4 years last week. But May 12th, that day also marks the beginning of some of our relationships with you folks, because some of you were there that day helping us unload. And I got to tell you, there was one person I met in particular that day. It was a hot day like this one, and people are working, unloading things, and I go out to our U-Haul to grab something, and I see somebody who has planted himself at the front of inside the U-Haul, and he's grabbing the boxes and moving them out so people can just grab them. And it's hot, and he's working really hard, and he's sweating. And I look at him, and I'm like, man, this guy's got to be at least in his 70s. And so I, you know, hey, man, how are you? Are you doing okay? Do you need some help? And he just kind of looks at me, and he's like, no, I'm good. Things are great. Just doing my job. It was the most cheerful. This man never complained the entire day. And so I had no idea that this was my first impression of Clyde Russell. And that I was learning in that exact moment a whole lot about who Clyde is. Because I've still never heard him complain about anything. Also, I found out later he was not in his mid-70s. He was in his mid-80s. Strong man. But that's the kind of person he was. I couldn't help thinking about your service to my family in that day and many days since. We have a lot of servants here. It's been incredible in the last few months. We have some kind of newer people in our church family who have stepped up to help with things like our children's ministry. We've got some new young teachers who themselves are not parents, but have committed themselves and have taken responsibility for some of our own young disciples. And I'm grateful for that. Honestly, we need a little bit more of that. Our children's ministry, we could use more teachers. And so if you have not thought of that, think about that. Think about what it means to take responsibility if you're part of this congregation. If you're not, think about what it means to take responsibility wherever it is that God has placed you. We have gentlemen who routinely step up to pray, to lead us in worship, to pass communion chairs around. That's wonderful. We need more of that. We need more. If you've not done that ever, think about what it means to take responsibility. Just go ahead, step up. I'm grateful for people. I'm grateful for John Fletcher. A couple weeks ago, Hilton, our elder, announced that John had asked if he could retire from being a deacon. And begrudgingly, everybody said, okay, we'll let you. But it's going to be hard. How long have you been serving? Do you have any idea how long you've been a deacon here? 35, 40 years. Okay. If after 35, 40 years of an unpaid service, you want to retire, we'll let you retire. Think about that. Think about a man who has, not just John, but Mary too, who have taken responsibility for this church. We are grateful for that, and we honor that. We're going to honor you in just a minute before our shepherd's prayer with a little something, nothing big. So here's our challenge. Last week I challenged you to spend time with God this week, or this past week. I'm going to challenge you to do that again. If you've not done it, we're building habits here, okay? So spend time with God this week. Take some time, carve it out. To show up for God who calls us his children. But today's challenge, this week's challenge, to do service, we're not just talking about it, we're not just remembering it, we're not studying the Bible, we're going to actually do it. Commit yourself to two acts of service this week. Identify somebody that needs something, and then figure out a way to meet that need. Just serve somebody. And then serve somebody else. And my encouragement would be to serve one person who's part of this church with you, if you're a part of our church together, or if you're not, if you're part of a church somewhere else, somebody in your Christian family. And then somebody who is not. Somebody at work, somebody that you go to the gym with, anything. You guys can do that, right? Come on, we got 7 days, 2 acts of service, no big deal. Excellent. We're going to check in next week about that, see if you did your homework. Here's what we're doing. We're allowing Christ to mold us and to shape us into His image. We are allowing Christ to teach us what it means to not seek ways of being served, but to serve. Paul tells us in Philippians chapter 2 to let our minds be shaped by the mind of Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God as something to be used to His advantage. Rather, He made Himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant and being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, He humbled Himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted Him to the highest place and gave Him the name that is above every name, that at that name every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God our Father. Let's stand and worship our God.